The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host, guest, random reptoid, or chupacabra may not necessarily reflect those of AM 950 Radio, its affiliates, or its sponsors. Now, it's time to step into the unknown. There are things people experience but never talk about. A shadow moving in the corner, flickering of the lights, a disembodied voice. We invite you to talk with us. Share your story, share your experience. Because this isn't just your story, this is our story. This is Ghost Box Radio with Greg Bakken.
And this is Ghost Box Radio on AM 950, where every night we talk about the paranormal, ufology, Bigfoot, and so much more. My name is Greg Bakken, and thank you very much for joining me. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. This is really cool if you're tuning in on Thanksgiving, and hopefully you have your tummies full of whatever you're eating. I don't know, turkey. I think that's what everyone eats. I'm not the biggest turkey fan in the world. But, you know, whatever it takes for you. I hope you had a good day. Hope you had a good day with your family and whatnot. You know, we're normally closed on Thanksgiving at the station, but, you know, last night we did a episode on the commemorating the milestone of the 60th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. And this is interesting. And as I mentioned last night, this is also the 60th anniversary today of one of my favorite shows. It's been with me. It's turned my life around, and it's going to sound silly when you talk about it, but we're really going to celebrate this program tonight. And I'm talking about, today is the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who, and it's a big deal for a lot of us, and I wanted to be able to commemorate it. And so tonight I decided to bring on a couple friends of mine. We've been on this journey together for some time. And it's really exciting to be able to do this. We rib each other all the time, but we also love this series, and we love talking about it. So with me tonight, I have Mike Rogers, who I've known for literally forever, and Robert Franks, almost forever. We're both, all three of us are pretty major Doctor Who fans. And gentlemen, welcome to Ghost Box Radio.
Hi, Greg.
Good evening.
Good evening. And so thank you for taking some time off of Thanksgiving to come and talk with me tonight. You know, I want to kind of give a little bit of a primer to folks who may have heard. I mean, I think most everyone's heard of Doctor Who. To be able to explain what Doctor Who is, I think is not quite as easy anymore. I mean, it could get very complex, and I think it could get very easy. I don't know if either of you want to try to explain what Doctor Who is, or you want me to, because it does, we only have an hour here, and it does get to be a lot. But you know, Mike, if you were to talk, and I'm, you know, you being a teacher and all, I'm sure that you've explained to a number of people what Doctor Who is. What would you tell people?
Gosh, it's kind of funny you ask, because I'd never really like thought about how to describe it to other folks. You
right.
Know, it's just like, because, you know, we've watched it for so many years, it just kind of is. But I suppose at its essence, it's about kind of a loner, an outsider, someone who's out on adventures, someone who's exploring the universe, someone who's always battling for good against evil, and doing it on a skin-tight budget, too, for the BBC.
What I like about that is that you did not bring up the term Time Lord once. And if it were up to me to if I was going to describe it, I would have said a traveler. I would have said a traveler who travels throughout all of time and space, and could take part in any adventure, any sort of situation, and is often called upon to be the leader, the hero, to be the voice of common sense, and that they inherently are about doing good, and they are about being on the side of right. And sometimes there's a little bit of wavering in there, but it's generally, you know, about that. And it's a great action adventure, and it's a series that could survive in any genre. I mean, it's a series about everything. You know, you have Seinfeld, the series about nothing. Doctor Who is like the series about everything.
Yeah, it's like it has the ultimate flexible format because it's about time travel and exploring the universe. You literally could be in a historical Earth setting in 1 week and then be on an alien planet the next.
Absolutely. You know, one of the big things that has happened to us Doctor Who fans over the past year is the announcement that Doctor Who is no longer in the U.S. going to be running on something like BBC America. It is not going to be, you know, it's not going to be available the same way it had been before. It's now moving to Disney Plus. It's in a sense under that umbrella of being one of those series that is going to become more. Robert, with that information in mind, I mean, obviously I'm going to ask you folks questions. You and I, we've all three of us talked about 100 billion times before. But, you know, Robert, what's your take on it going over to Disney Plus?
Well, I don't know. We're kind of going to see how that goes in the future because I mean, at this point, they haven't really even announced. We've got a soft announcement that the broadcast of the new episodes are going to be at the exact same time as they are on BBC One in the UK. But there hasn't been a major announcement from Disney that that's what's happening yet. Yeah. So I still think there's a lot of things to come from that. Obviously, Disney Plus doesn't control the show. They're putting money in, same as, you know, like ABC has in the past, same as back in the classic era, and the same as, you know, like the Canadian network CBC has in the modern era. Mm-hmm. And so but that doesn't give them a say over what Doctor Who is or does, but they may have more say over, say, some of the spin-off series that we keep hearing about. But again, there's only soft kind of announcements about those so far and nothing definitive yet.
No, and one of the things, too, that we kind of, you know, in case people don't quite realize, and I can't imagine they wouldn't, but you never know, is the fact that the lead actor who is Doctor Who, whenever that person decides that they no longer want to play the role, generally speaking, they quit and they hire someone else to play the role. And the series had run from 1963 to 1989 with a one-off TV movie in 1996, came back in 2005, has been running since then. And since then, we have had a number of actors playing the Doctor. But what's interesting is the last Doctor, the 13th Doctor, was played by Jodie Whittaker, the first female to play the role. And then when she decided to leave, she regenerates. And not only does she regenerate, but the production crew regenerates. And we go back to David Tennant, which he was the 10th Doctor. I know it sounds confusing for people who have never, I mean, it's confusing me a little bit. But you know, Mike, I mean, it's one of the things that makes Doctor Who actually pretty charming, I think, is the fact that you know, we're excited, I guess, in a sense that David Tennant is back and he is not the same. What we understand is he's not the same Doctor as he was the 10th Doctor, but he's the 14th Doctor.
Yeah. Which I think is like the first time in the show's history that they brought the same actor back to play the role a second time in a new incarnation.
Not counting the curator.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we'll get into a debate. That's another episode.
What Doctor Who fans have different opinions on things? Oh, my goodness. I never.
I mean, that's like you said, that's where, for me as a fan, that's where the excitement really has always been. You know, you enjoy the Doctor that you're currently watching, but there's always this excitement about what's the new actor who's going to take this role? What fresh take are they going to bring to it? You know, what direction is the show going to go towards? So for me, regenerations are always like an exciting time. And it kind of, it kind of re-energizes, I think, the fan base.
I also think it's interesting, too, that like this was the case that with when David Tennant left and Matt Smith took over. So at the end of End of Time, as well as Jodie's last episode, The Power of the Doctor, that literally at the end of the episode, it's pretty much not only do we get the reveal of a new doctor, but we do get a reveal of a new production team because they have a hand always in that. It literally is within the end of that story that you have a whole new take on the production as well. And, you know, Robert, do you see it the same way as Mike? I mean, I agree. I feel like it's very exciting. It's kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm just lame. I think it's kind of scary at the same time because it's like, I don't know what I'm going to get, but that's kind of the purpose of it, right?
But also, you know, keep in mind, you lucked out twice upon a time when, again, the Doctor, Peter Capaldi, at the end of that, regenerated into Jodie and a whole new production team came in.
Oh, right. You forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, we've obviously, since we've been around and for a long time and following the classic series before the series had even come back, I mean, that happened quite often. There was a switchover in 1969 from the production team to into like the color era and switching over, not quite the very first episode was the same production team, but yeah. And similar. I mean, that oftentimes when the doctors would leave, a new production team would come in and start over. And that's why I mentioned, you know, Twice Upon a Time, because with Chris Chibnall coming in, it was much more of a let's start over fresh. When Matt Smith and Moffat came in, we got a little bit of a soft relaunch and the fans were a little unsure.
Yep.
But quickly, I think Moffat convinced him that, you know, this isn't going to be that bad. But I mean, he kept a lot of the same elements, you know, the keeping Murray Gold and some other things that Russell already had in place. And but with Chibnall, he kind of wiped away a lot of that, brought in new teams for a lot of everything to give the whole show a very new feel. And I mean, from the beginning of the first episode, the Woman Who Fell to Earth, you kind of felt it. I mean, you don't really see her opening credit sequence until her second episode.
No.
But that opening sequence is of, you know, vastly different than what we've had for any of the other modern era doctors, too.
It's a very good point. And, you know, even just general norms that some of us Doctor Who nerds, and I'm really considering myself in that. I'm not going to throw you both into it. I mean, even though you both are, but you know, the thing is too, like the norms, the Doctor Who norms that we always rely on that I love, you know, just the opening and closing credits. Like you said, Robert, you know, when it's a new doctor, the opening credits are always the exciting part, what the new doctor credits look like. But sometimes we'd get popular music for the end credits during Jodie's era, which is unheard of, you know, I mean, you know, but it's like, it's those things, you know, looking back at them, it's like they're not bad. At the time, it's like, oh, scary, different music. Oh, my gosh, you know. But, you know, now I look back and I'm like, you know, I mean, at least he had the guts to try, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that, I mean, Mike, I know that you love just about anything that has a diamond logo on it. So I'm sure that you approved of everything the moment it happened.
I can sense your judginess penetrating through the ether and over into my camera over here.
Right, it's oozing through. It's just seepage, yeah. Carmine seepage.
No, I think one thing I've always kind of wondered, like, because, you know, when Doctor Who rebooted in 2005, it was very popular. And I've always, in the back of my mind, kind of worried a little bit about Doctor Who in that sense, that if it becomes such a popular thing and such a commodity for the BBC or for the people that make it in general, that they begin to pull their punches. They don't take some risks. In other words, you know, they just play it safe and kind of keep giving us the same thing over and over. And so that's always been kind of my worry with New Who, is that, I mean, I'm always appreciative of how popular it is and how it's reaching new audiences, but I kind of enjoyed the classic era because it felt like they took more risks and kind of took the series in different directions at times, usually at those production shifts.
Very much so. And I feel like that that is one of the things that, I mean, It's funny because I think that fans today may not really care about that. I mean, like the fans that are modern to the series, because that's how television works now to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's I mean, and I don't know, Robert, as we have just about under a minute left for the segment. I mean, you've commented a lot about like the way that television is made today and the impact that that has. I mean, don't you? Would you say that too? That I mean, a lot of the stuff that's new to us is not really probably registering with contemporary viewers.
Okay, so yeah, I guess kind of what you and Mike are talking about is how like the production teams really throw out changes that shock fandom, and it was making me remember back even before we were really in fandom. Deadly Assassin in the classic series, which was a big culture shock, and a lot of fans were not happy with how that changed Time Lord society and other things, the mythos of Doctor Who. And it's very, very similar to what happened recently with the Timeless Child from the Chris Chibnall era, and how different fans have either taken that as a huge shockwave or they've embraced it. So I think these production teams do the same things over and over.
Yeah, I suppose you have to be very. I mean, to be able to thrive, you have to kind of shake things up a little bit, don't you? Mm-hmm. Time and time again. Why don't we go ahead and do this? I'm going to go ahead take our first break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how old we are because. I think our first milestone anniversary was the 20th anniversary. We're going to talk about when we got into fandom and the changes since then. You're listening to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. And welcome back to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. My name is Greg Bach, and happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I hope you had a great holiday. I am here with my friends on Thanksgiving, and we are celebrating what our favorite show, Doctor Who, celebrates its 60th anniversary today. It kind of blows my mind a little bit. And I have with me two friends with me tonight, Michael Rogers and Robert Franks. We've been friends for a very long time. We've been in fandom for a very long time. Just a very quick kind of a history on me doing this. I got into this just after the 20th anniversary of the series back in 1984. So it was all new to me, and like all of us, and I've talked about this other places before, we kind of get a piecemeal of the history, you know, and there was no internet and stuff. We kind of had to buy magazines or books or whatever to kind of figure out what was the history of this series, which was a lot smaller than it is now, the history that is. I've been involved with fandom since I started being a fan of the show in 1984. I got involved in fandom, probably 86, 87, and then done a lot with Doctor Who fandom all around the world since then. Mike, when did you get into Doctor Who? If you don't mind carbon dating yourself.
It was back in the Pleistocene era.
Right. Well, I was watching it when it was cave drawings.
Now, for me, it was a very similar story. It was 1982 for me, actually. And I recall I was about 12 years old, and my mother forced me to sit down and watch it.
Yes.
I didn't want to. I was like, what's she going on about? She made me sit down and watch the very first episode of Robot, which is Tom Baker, the Fourth Doctor's premiere story, and I was hooked immediately right after that. And I suppose for me, I was growing up in a small town in Iowa at the time, so fandom was just unheard of. Like, I was the only person I knew of that watched the show on PBS.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't until I moved to Minnesota around 1986 where I attended my first convention and really started to get a taste of what it's like to interact with other folks that love the show, too.
What convention was it? That would have been the Colin and Patrick Troughton convention?
Yep, the Two Doctors convention in Minneapolis at the Armory.
That's right, yeah. Now, Robert, there's more, Mike? Is there more?
Oh, no. Well, unless you'd like more, Greg. Would you like me to talk more?
No one wants that. No, I'm just kidding. We'll get back to you. Robert, if I'm not mistaken, you starred in the first episode of Doctor Who in 1963. No, I'm just kidding. When did you get into it? Fairly close, yeah.
I had seen Doctor Who on and off on PBS stations. They were airing the first 4 years of the Tom Baker series, starting in 78. It would be very hard to catch consistently because it was on around dinner time and having to do chores. Lived out on a farm at the time,
and you're in Ohio.
Yes, similar to Mike, it was a very small area. Like, so I knew nobody else around that even liked science fiction. I would force my sister to watch some stuff from time to time, but I can tell you the date. It was October 16th, 1982, when I decided, okay, I'm a Doctor Who fan from now on out. I'm not going to miss any more episodes. I'm going to watch this every single week. It was Brain and Morbius was on that night, and I have watched Doctor Who every chance I get after that.
Up to, including today, including now, right?
Yes. Including, yes, today, watching the Daleks in color.
Mike, what did you think of the Daleks in color?
I don't know if I like Barbara's pink shirt. I'm just going to throw it out there. I know we were going to steer clear of controversy, but the color of the blouse is just, I might have to just throw away all of my Blu-rays and DVDs after that.
here's the thing is, Mike, you mentioned it, like to find a Doctor Who fan when we were fans, like a fellow Doctor Who fan, it was not easy. The conventions were great, but like amongst our daily lives, back then, and I'll speak for myself, if I saw somebody who had anything that said Doctor Who on it, they'd probably have been mobbed by me, you know, just like, oh my gosh, now. How often are you out and you see somebody with like a TARDIS backpack or something on like a bumper sticker or something like that? I mean, the accessibility, Mike, now of people who, like, everybody seems to like it. Do you ever get old? You are old, but does it ever get old that you have that moment of like, gosh, this is a popular show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is a bit surreal because growing up in the classic era, I mean, we enjoyed it, but it wasn't necessarily like the height of culture to bring this to your friend group and say, hey guys, let's sit down and watch an episode together.
Yeah.
So like in particular, I noticed it around the 50th anniversary is when it was really permeating American culture heavily.
Yeah.
And I'm a teacher, school teacher. And so a lot of my middle school students would pick up on references or they'd mention it in passing and I would be like, oh, you watch that too, huh? It's a bit surreal being a fan of that certain age to see it being so popular amongst so many people. It's really kind of fun.
And I suppose you play it cool. I've heard of that.
That show?
I might have caught a couple episodes. I totally know about that. I mean, and Robert, we had quite the experience. We went out to New York. Mike wasn't invited to this, purposely.
Lost my invite, apparently. Huh?
Yeah, I'm sure that's what happened. Robert and I, we went to the premiere of both the first Matt Smith episode and the first Peter Capaldi episode. And we went on behalf of BBC America. They gave us passes because we were able to finagle a few things. And we were at the hotel bar across the street from where the Capaldi the premiere was. And the bartender there, Robert, it's like you could talk publicly about being a Doctor Who fan, I think, you know. That was pretty cool, I think. This is probably one of my favorite memories about the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't recall being embarrassed to say that as a Doctor Who fan, but it did no good to talk to people when you, you said, go to a bar and talk to the bartender because they would have no idea what that was, or they might possibly go, is that the one with the guy in the scarf?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, And that's about it as far as pop culture went. And it's everywhere now. I mean, to be able to go into Target and buy a, you know, TARDIS shower curtain, it's just kind of like mind boggling.
And even going into like a Barnes and Noble or something, just picking up Doctor Who magazine, that's pretty crazy too. You know, and I remember I must have been like in 9th or 10th grade or something. We had a some kind of guest speaker. He was older. He's probably my age now, but he was probably, I think he was like in his 50s. Oh God. He looked like kind of like Santa Claus, and he just he was talking about something, and he was like looking at everybody we talked like a speaker would, and then he said, or something like the adventures of like Doctor Who. And when he said it, he looked directly at me. And I thought, oh my God, how does he know? You know, I mean, just like, it was just like that fear of like, does everyone else staring at me about it? Because I'm not embarrassed by it. I wasn't embarrassed by it, but like you said, it wasn't something you bring up, and I wasn't embarrassed by the show. I was embarrassed by the reaction people would give about it. And one of the things that I remember the most was like my parents would really, my dad in particular, he just really didn't like the show, and he would rip on it, and he ended up watching, like he fell asleep in his, you know, when he was in his bedroom, and he watched Attack of the Cybermen, like it just was on, and he was like, God, I watched that was horrible, I hate it, you know, all this stuff. And then years after I move out and I come to their house, and they're watching Tenant, you know, they're watching the show. You know, Mike, you had mentioned that your mom got you into it. Did your family, was it a family thing with your parents and you at all?
I think it was in the first maybe few months, but then kind of like with Robert, it just kind of galvanized within me, and then I was just a fanatic.
You're like, Gum, it's mine. The precious is mine.
So I don't recall my parents really spending a lot of time watching it with me, although I think my mom always kind of like watched it out of the corner, maybe out of interest.
Behind the sofa.
Exactly. And it was a big deal back in 1982. We had to actually buy a VCR. This was a video recording machine, because, you know, it was on at 10 p.m. and little Michael can't stay up that late.
He still can't.
I know, right? Now I try and I just fall asleep.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Robert. You know, as Doctor Who fans and those of us who like to collect the program, whether it's, you know, on DVD, VHS, whatever, Doctor Who has kind of set the standard for folks like you and I on technology, on the technology that we bring into our house and recordings or whatever else. I mean, you know, and you're probably the poster child for that, too, to be very honest.
I was. Yeah. I mean, I made my first recording with a borrowed Beta VCR in March of 1984 to record the Five Doctors, mm-hmm. when it was repeated during a pledge drive. And I later bought a VHS, so I could never play that Beta ever again. the reason I bought a VHS was I saved up my money specifically because I needed to record Doctor Who to have all of them on tape. And I planned out which stories were going to go on which tapes, had all of them bought and labeled even before there was anything recorded on them. And then buying them when they started to be released on VHS, then on Laserdisc, then on DVD. Every time that I've upgraded to new technology, it's been because of Doctor Who, so that I could get better recordings.
And you, folks, I hope you understand when I ask Robert that question, I might be a little jokey about it. I by no means am disagreeing with anything he says, because I've been right there with Robert, you know, maybe not the first to get that, but I've certainly have gone. Yes.
Who was it that convinced you to buy a PAL television?
Well, exactly. Well, that was Jonathan.
Well, yes. Okay.
No, it is important. I mean, it's stuff that, you know, and you know, my parents had often said to me, they're just like, you know, we're not the biggest fan of the show, but it kept you off the streets. You know, I mean, it kept me from being in drugs or something. You know, there's worse things that we could be instead of like wearing scarves and stuff. You know, I do want to say, because we have about 3 minutes left in this segment. I just want to say, now that this is the 60th anniversary, and Mike, I'm sorry that you weren't a part of this. For the 50th anniversary is probably one of my favorite memories, Robert, of us watching Day of the Doctor at your work in the IDS Tower. And we all brought really high-end, like, hors d'oeuvres, snacks and stuff. And one of our friends, what's that?
Champagne.
We went out to Manny's afterwards, and we had steak dinner that was fantastic. And then one of our friends, because we brought all these, like, high-end things, and one of our friends is like, well, I'll bring Doritos. And you're like, no, don't bring them. We're not going to eat them. We don't want to see them on the table. Because this was meant to be high, like a really big celebration. But that day was just really special because we had simulcast, which, you know, how time flies, simulcast around the world, which, you know, was a big deal. Now, you know, look at streaming. That wasn't really a thing back then. And then we had the Five-ish Doctors that I didn't even know about. That was a lot of fun, Robert. I really enjoyed that.
Yep. And not the only thing that was being, like, broadcast around the world. That was also 1D Day that was being shown around the world too. It's two events being shown around the world on the same day.
That's right. Mike, you're very, you know, you have really brought your children into the Doctor Who world. I'm assuming when that aired, you were probably watching it with them.
Oh yeah, absolutely. When you mentioned that, I pictured myself sitting upstairs on the floor, leaning up against the couch, and I remember everyone's reaction when Tom Baker showed up at the very end as the curator.
As a doctor. Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun to watch other people enjoy it too. My children, unfortunately, just had no choice. They were raised on the old classic stuff, and so when the new Who came out, they were instantly into that too. But it's fun to see other people enjoy things that you enjoy.
They were confused. They thought it was a religion. Because it was so such a big part of your life that they just thought that was like organized religion for them.
And can I just quickly point out
please.
That, you know, we're 10 years on and One Direction is no longer a thing. They've broken up. Doctor Who is celebrating another decade.
Yeah, you can't stop it. It keeps going. And it's you know, and talk about, and yeah, we have a couple seconds left. So I'm just going to say real fast, talk about an influx of like popularity with or influx of energy, I guess, really, with Russell coming back on and the Disney Plus stuff. I mean, those are pretty incredible things. Gentlemen, why don't we go ahead? We'll take another break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking. I want to ask these gentlemen about some of their favorite parts of being Doctor Who fans as we celebrate the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who. You're listening to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. And welcome back to Ghost Box Radio with Greg Bach. We're going to be talking for the last segment more about Doctor Who, the 60th anniversary. It's really exciting. I love these anniversaries, and I love the production teams come out with a lot of stuff for us to enjoy and get excited about. You know, I'm going to take this last segment, Mike and Robert, and I want to talk about some of our favorite things about the story and about the series, I guess. Now, first of all, for those who are noticing, our learned friend Robert seems to be wearing a little something a little else going on there. What's going on there, Robert? What do you got on you?
Do I have something on me? I have a wonderful scarf that was made by a good friend that is completely screen accurate. Mm-hmm. And I might be somebody who was on this episode of your show.
I'm blushing. I didn't know you knew I made them. No. So Mike, you make these scarves. I have one as well from you. And you know, for those of you who do not know, and Mike, do not hate them for this. Tom Baker's scarf is not the same throughout his entire 7-year run. Lots of variations, and you have made it your mission to create, and this is no small feat, create these scarves and make them screen accurate.
This is not small by any stretch of the
imagination. No. Mike, what is it that really excites you about creating these scarves? What is it that you like doing it for?
Well, part of it is nostalgia because back when I was about 15 or so, well, actually a little younger, when I first started watching it, I didn't know how to knit or crochet or any of that stuff, but my mom did. And of course, I was really into the show. And so I convinced her to make one for me. But then, of course, started to realize, hey, I could get better colors. And the more episodes I watched and taped, I realized I could get the pattern a little more accurate. So I tried to convince her a second time. And at that point, she's like, how about if you learn how to knit or crochet, and then you can make one? And so part of it is just the nostalgia of watching these episodes over and over, trying to figure it out. Then later as an adult, came back to making the scarves about, I don't know, maybe about 8 or 9 years ago. And at that point, the internet was full of information. Like, you can go and find all sorts of like detailed analysis of all of the costumes, let alone just this scarf that the Fourth Doctor wore. Mm-hmm. So now it's fun to try to get the fine details of it, you know, get the colors right, get all of the different features that are on it. So now it's a bit of a quest, kind of a rabbit hole, but it's a really enjoyable one. And and then I maybe give scarves to friends too, to show them I appreciate them.
And you sell them, right? I mean, you offer yeah. freelance and stuff. And do you mind if we talk about if someone here would like a sure. screen accurate scarf, how would mm-hmm. they get a hold of you?
My email would be spacetimenerd@gmail.com. Very fitting.
Yep. Very, very true. Well, and I mean, but you know, as my mom would say, it keeps you off the streets. So, honestly, these are beautiful. And I mean, how long does it take you to make one generally?
Well, they were of different lengths, so it kind of depends on the one that I'm attempting to make. And it depends on how much spare time.
Just answer that damn question, will you? Well, it depends on if the sun comes up at.
This whole segment is going to be about scarves, ladies and gentlemen. So just kick back, open up the can. now, I would say it takes roughly about maybe a couple months of knitting on the side after work to make kind of a standard scarf. And then the really long ones can take 3 or 4 or 5 months, depending on on how much spare time you got.
And you have more than one scarf going at once?
No, I usually try to just do one at a time, just sure. to kind of power through.
Yeah, no, because it focus is yeah. good.
And the one I'm most proud of would be the one over my shoulder here. That would be the last one that Tom Baker wore for his final season. And it's made out of like a special kind of yarn called chenille, which is not the most important thing. But I was able to track down some of the original chenille that was actually used for the real screen accurate one and be able to like recreate it faithfully that way. So not just matching from some modern day yarn, but actually getting 40-year-old yarn that somehow is still in people's attics and they occasionally clean out and sell on eBay.
Sorry,
so that was a quest.
Sorry, ladies, he's married.
already taken, folks. Sorry, I am the complete package.
Robert, you know, what is it that do you? I this is a really tough question. What is something that you absolutely love about Doctor Who? That just makes you that, you know, amongst everything is just really something you love the most about the show.
Well, and I think that, I mean, we'll all agree that we have an interest in this, but this is, again, what kind of, I knew I liked the show, but this kind of dragged me in trying to find out information about the show, because back, like you said, when we were doing it, couldn't find Doctor Who magazine in America. You couldn't get, you know, you had to find out like information. I had to find out, oh, there were other doctors before Tom Baker, and I had to put together my own episode guide, and come to discover missing episodes and the rabbit hole that mm-hmm. that is, and been, you know, investigating and trying to find out more and more about that for going on 40 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that I mean, really, it's because there's so much to find out that is, oh, well, that isn't true. That's a rumor. Or this is, you know, this is what happened to this one specific print and how it turned up again later. And it's a lot of information to dig into and just kind of like spend hours trying to find out more and more. And, you know, yeah, in school I could have been discovering, you know, like studying astronomy or biology or those kind of things and put it forth in making money in my adult life. Instead, I decided to just investigate missing episodes. And yeah, and spend lots of money to recreate them and other things.
Right.
And not make any actual money off.
Mike, what about you?
In terms of what question again? Just what?
Wow.
And I was just so enamored with what Robert was saying.
Yeah. What is if you had something that's a favorite thing about Doctor Who, what would it be? And feel free to pay attention whenever you like.
Well, I was going to say it's connecting with people like you, Greg, but I think I'm reconsidering that.
We knew that was a lie. Yeah.
No, I mean, for me, like starting out as a fan, it was you were very isolated. And then, you know, you kind of gradually work into fandom. And as Robert described, you know, you start to pick up on information from books and magazines. So for me, I think it's just being able to connect to other people that also enjoy it. Like the three of us can sit and gab about this for hours and hours.
Yep.
And we routinely do. And then we go, oh my gosh, you know, half the evening is gone and we're just chatting and laughing and quoting different parts of it. And going into the minutia of like film prints and missing episodes it's such a rich tapestry. You have so many different things that you could focus on and experiences, and it's just fun to share that with other people.
Absolutely. Well,
and to bring friends together, think about the fact that, you know, like Greg has mentioned a couple of times on this episode already, I used to live in Ohio, and I live in basically just, you know, like 20 miles from you, Mike. Now, we all live in the Twin Cities because, I met Greg at a convention, struck up a friendship, and Mike, I met you over the internet, and then came to find out, oh, this guy I've been talking to is, like, here, too.
Right.
And I moved here, you know, 23 years ago, and because of connections I made through fandom.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you interested in knowing, 97 Doctor Who episodes from the 60s do not exist, and that they're lost. They were destroyed, and possibly film prints exist. We won't get into the minutia of it because that's another 5 episodes. Yeah. But just know that stuff does get found, and back it was 10 years ago that a bunch of episodes were released that were found. But the reason why I want to bring that up too is because, Robert, that's my favorite thing about Doctor Who as well. Still, I think you both nailed it. Yes, the friendship stuff is fantastic, but the missing episodes, there's something about that mystery. For Doctor Who fans, that's kind of the true crime part of Doctor Who, where it's like, mm-hmm. these are gone. Why are they gone? Where did they go? There's always, for something that happened 60 years ago, 50 years ago, there is new information that always comes around. It's just exciting to talk about it, and stuff gets found all the time. So, yeah, I mean, that is one of my favorite things. And one of the things that, you know, is shocking to me, and today is a great example of it, is those missing episodes. They've been reconstructed in the past. Robert had worked on that in his time doing all this stuff. But now they're animating a bunch of these. And today, Robert and I got the latest animation on Blu-ray from the UK. I mean, the stuff that has happened, and we only have about 4 minutes left, the stuff that's happened, though, that when we were young, those seemed like pipe dreams, like John Pertwee episodes that only existed in black and white when they should have been colored. They're now color. The missing episodes, they are being revitalized in ways that we all joked about. Wouldn't it be great if there was, you know, animated versions of them? And it's happening. I mean, Mike, I mean, could you believe it?
No, absolutely not. And even just like realizing that there were audio recordings of the missing episodes. So like there are these layers that you just kind of like, you know, you look back and you think, wow, like how fortunate are we as a fandom? Just to the level of detail and love and attention that the franchise still garners after 60 years.
And Robert, it always felt like to me that when it comes to home media and stuff, and even just anything Doctor Who, it, you know, maybe in the beginning it was, you know, very early on in the 80s, maybe stuff was slapdashed, but it really feels like really from the mid-90s onward, and even before that, Doctor Who has always been for a brand that maybe wasn't the highest seller for the BBC after its first cancellation, but it always was taken care of pretty well. That's always surprised me, and in a good way.
And that is really, because goes back to the fans, because people that were young fans grew up, got into, you know, working in television, both, you know, in front of the camera, behind the camera. I mean, all of our current era producers have been fans when they were young and grew up knowing they wanted to make Doctor Who. And some of the stars of the show now grew up as fans of the series. And, you know, it's the same thing. Some of the people working on doing, you know, figuring out how to do restoration, a lot of stuff has been pioneered because Doctor Who fans wanted to restore some of their episodes. And then someone said, oh, we can use this to restore other movies and television. And it's incredible. I see, you know, like I get a Blu-ray showing how they've restored a, you know, a really classic film, Metropolis, and how they went about all of the restoration work and that. And I'm like, yeah, they've been doing that to Doctor Who for years.
And better.
And some of it's like witchcraft, like the whole chroma dot technology thing that was developed by Doctor Who fans to be able to extract the color out of black and white prints and restore color episodes. It's kind of amazing when you think about like all of the advances that have happened simply because of the love of that program.
And what I also like about it too is like Doctor Who itself is like the history of television production in the UK from the 60s. It's lasted for so long that you are actually seeing how television was made in the mainstream all throughout the last, you know, not 60 years because there was a gap, but still, it's, I love that part about Doctor Who as a study in television. You couldn't get a better case study.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that the show in the 60s was almost shot live. Like they could afford maybe two or three edits. And so big, long sequences were just filmed right there from, and they'd have to budget their time to get the actors to another set because they couldn't afford to cut. So yeah, it's really truly amazing to watch that archival television from the 60s as they're inventing the medium.
Truly. I mean, who would have thought that program that started in a junkyard, paced as live, and the hero of the show, his introduction to the British audience is him, you know, hacking up a lung. It comes this way. Robert, we're running out of time. We have about 30 seconds left. Anything you want to add about Doctor Who that has impressed you over the years?
Just that the classic and the new series are mixed together wonderfully well. I mean, just this week, the Radio Times released some 60th anniversary photos and happened to have the very first companion from the very first episode right alongside the most recent companion.
The lineage is beautiful, and this is a fantastic 60th anniversary. My dear friends, happy 60th anniversary to Doctor Who. What a fun day. Thank you both very much for joining me. We'll be back next week with more, not Doctor Who, but paranormal. Everyone have a great weekend.